headlines, U.S. President Joe Biden hails the Nordic nations of Finland and Sweden for their bid to join the NATO military alliance. Russia says over 1,700 Ukrainian soldiers holed up in a steel plant in the port city of Mariupol have surrendered since Monday. And China calls for the expansion of a group of emerging economies known as BRICS in the first shakeup of the bloc over a decade. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. U.S. President Joe Biden says that he has met with the leaders of Finland and Sweden at the White House to offer robust support for their applications to join NATO. In the meeting, Biden said Finland and Sweden would make NATO stronger. He said their accession would enhance the security of the alliance and deepen security cooperation across the board. That is, as Turkey has threatened to block the Nordic nations from becoming members of the alliance. It has pressed Sweden to halt support for the Kurdish Workers' Party, PKK. It considers as a terrorist group and left their bounds on some arms sales to Turkey. All 13 NATO members need to approve Stockholm and Helsinki's bid to join the alliance. Sweden and Finland have for decades stood outside the military alliance, but Russia's military operation in Ukraine appears to have heightened their security concerns. Russia says more than 700 Ukrainian fighters have surrendered in the steelworks plant 24 hours in the city of Mariupol. That brings to over 1,700 the number of forces in the plant who have put down their weapons over the past several days after being trapped there for more than 2 months. However, Moscow says some 1,000 Ukrainian troops, including top commanders, are still fighting in Mariupol. The city is the biggest that Russia has so far captured in the war since it began in February 24th.
Much of Mariupol may lie in ruins, but the city is already coming back to life after months of fierce fighting. A market is open, selling all essential goods, and humanitarian aid is being distributed by organizations associated with the Russian government.
These days, the situation is more or less stabilized. People are fed. There are more problems with water, electricity and gas in some parts, and there are still problems with basic domestic needs.
Amongst the ruins, I came across a gathering who are waiting for a drop-off of humanitarian supplies.
During the fighting, I was at home. When there were battles, the house was shaking. I stood with my back to the wall and I was shaking with the wall. When I think of it, I still shiver. There was nothing good about the fighting. We don't want anything except peace and quiet now.
The population of Mariupol before the war was about 450,000. Now, it's hard to estimate, but we think around a third of those people still remain, either stayed during the battle or stayed nearby the city in camps and have now returned. Over the next days, weeks, months, years, we can expect many thousands of people to return here to Mariupol. But who will be those people? Before the conflict began, the city was very mixed between pro-Russian, Russian-speaking people and more Ukrainian nationalist, pro-Ukrainian people. Now that it's under Russian control, as long as it stays under Russian control, we can expect many of the Russian people to come back. But for the Ukrainians, they may well stay away, which means that the ethnic diversity in the city, the ethnic makeup of the city, will change.
It is not yet time to be happy about anything. But there are certain expectations that Russia is a rich country and its politics are more independent. And we hope things will improve.
How do you feel living under Russian rule now rather than Ukrainian?
You see, we cannot say anything yet. We don't understand anything yet. We only want it to be peaceful and quiet. That's what people want here. What else can we say?
Like many people I speak to in areas recently taken over by Russia, She is scared to answer such questions. She may be more pro-Ukrainian, or she might be worried that Russia might not be in control of Mariupol for long. Down by the port area, I found the incongruous sight of fishermen, seemingly oblivious to the fact that war was still raging across the country.
Of course I'm happy. Of course. Truth to tell, we've been waiting for it for a long time. Of course, yes, I'm happy to be under Russian control now, because we have become free. Well, we were free before, but not in this way. The attitude changed. People have a different attitude to each other now. Earlier, we were afraid to say things and speak our minds. Yes, I could get into trouble if I criticized the Ukrainian government.
This is commonly heard amongst Russian speakers here, that they have been marginalized and persecuted by the increasingly nationalist Ukrainian government. This is the reason the East rose up 8 years ago, and why many here welcome the Russians. Unless Ukraine takes back Mariupol, it will now likely be populated predominantly by an ethnic Russian population. Whatever the fate of this city, it will never be the same again. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The Kremlin says the removal of Western sanctions against Russia must be considered in order for Moscow to heed an appeal by the United Nations for access to Ukraine's ports to help ease a global food crisis. Moscow believes the sanctions play a key part in the current food crisis, as the bans interfere with normal free trade and target food products. This after the UN Secretary General said that he is in contact with various international players in an effort to restore exports of Ukrainian grain and Russian food and fertilizers under the current circumstances. The war in Ukraine and economic sanctions on Russia have pushed up global prices for grains, cooking oils, and fuel and fertilizers. Russia and Ukraine together account for nearly a third of global wheat supplies. Russia's deputy prime minister says half of Gazprom's 54 clients have opened accounts at Gazprom Bank as European companies look for ways to meet payment deadlines without breaking EU sanctions.
54 companies, big companies, medium and small ones. As I understand it, about a half of these companies have already opened special accounts in rubles and foreign currency at our designated bank to ensure revenue earnings by converting them into rubles and paying for the gas provided in rubles.
Alexander Novak says certain major companies are ready to pay on schedule. He says a list of gas buyers who paid in rubles will be finalized in the next couple of days. Moscow has called for buyers from nearly 50 unfriendly countries to start paying in rubles. Those countries include all EU member states, the United States, Japan, Switzerland, and Norway. Russia cut gas supplies to Bulgaria and Poland last month after they refused to pay in rubles. The EU advised firms against opening a bank account in rubles to pay for gas, but it has not explicitly said doing so would breach the sanctions against Russia. This has put some companies in uncertainty as to whether they can open such accounts to buy Russian gas. Iran's foreign ministry has announced the Islamic Republic's readiness to mediate in resolving the Ukraine crisis. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a telephone conversation with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The Russian foreign ministry says the two sides exchange views on international issues, including the situation in Ukraine. Lavrov said Moscow welcomes any initiative to restart negotiations with Kiev. He said Iran plays a constructive role in that regard. Russia and Ukraine have held several rounds of talks since the start of the war in February, but all ended without a breakthrough. The catastrophic collapse of the former Afghan government and national security forces, as well as the subsequent takeover of the country by the Taliban, were direct consequences of decisions made by U.S. presidents. This, according to an official U.S. agency report. Rahmatullah Bakhban reports.
Months after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, confessed that Washington was mainly to blame for the collapse of the former Afghan government and national security and defense forces. The report by SIGAR reveals that Afghan forces' morale were destroyed after then-U.S. President Donald Trump reached a deal with the Taliban in 2020, and President Joe Biden affirmed the U.S. withdrawal in 2021.
In my opinion, the Doha deal paved the way for the U.S.-led foreign forces' withdrawal from Afghanistan. It also gave the Taliban forces the belief that they can take over Afghanistan easily. In fact, the Doha deal and the U.S. withdrawal both were great achievements for the Taliban and Afghanistan.
Former Afghan generals and experts also told the agency that most American support to Afghan forces was stopped or limited, while the Taliban had intensified attacks.
I agree with the SIGAR report. The former Afghan Republic government was defeated when the U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban. After the Doha deal, the U.S. stopped its major logistic support, including fuel, rockets, arms, and air support to Afghan forces. It continued until the Afghan army completely ran out of equipment.
SIGAR notes that in essence, U.S. and Afghan efforts to cultivate an effective and sustainable security assistance sector were likely to fail from the beginning. Afghan experts also say that the U.S. never meant to build a nation or a state in the country, and all Western-backed armies are doomed to failure.
The former Afghan government was an example of American state-building. They invaded our country, formed their own government, and finally demolished it. They never meant to boost the state-nation process. The Americans appointed their own men to the Afghan government, while they were not representing Afghan people. In addition, the U.S. intentionally established a corrupt and dependent army in Afghanistan.
The Taliban took over Afghanistan in August 2021 as the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan and the former Western-backed government collapsed. Afghans are angry with the U.S. for pushing Afghanistan into a dire situation. People here believe Washington not only betrayed Afghans but also continues to harm them with sanctions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
China's president calls for unity among the members of emerging economies known as BRICS to shape the global security for all. Xi Jinping urges BRICS countries to enhance political trust and security cooperation to promote peace and development. Xi made the remarks in a virtual meeting of BRICS foreign ministers. Also speaking at the meeting, China's foreign minister said Beijing aims to expand BRICS. China will be hosting the other BRICS members, Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa, for the 14th summit of the organization in late June. North Korea reports over 260,000 more cases from fever of unidentified origin, pushing the total to over 2 million. The country's official news agency reported two more deaths, bringing the total fatalities to over 60. So far, North Korea has refused to link the fever cases to the COVID-19 pandemic. However, it confirmed last week that at least one of those died had been diagnosed with the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has slammed officials for not taking practical measures to timely prevent the outbreak of the virus. Kim has also imposed preventive measures, including restrictions on movements and quarantines. And health authorities in some countries in Europe and North America are on high alert for the spread of the rare monkeypox viral disease after the emergence of new cases. Portugal reported 5 cases in Spain, said nearly 24 cases were being tested. Britain has now detected 7 infections after it announced its first case earlier this month. The United States and Canada have also identified infections. Authorities are working with the World Health Organization to investigate the spread of the virus. Early symptoms of monkeypox include those similar to the flu, as well as swelling of lymph nodes followed by a rash. The first case of monkeypox was reported in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in the 1970s. The United Nations envoy on the impacts of sanctions has wrapped up her 10-day visit to Iran. Her trip was aimed at assessing the human rights violations caused by the United States sanctions on Iran. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali reports.
A witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran, Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
The UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem. Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the U.N. Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. This particular targeted killing of a journalist, not the first and sadly probably not the last, touched us all. And the response of the Zionist establishment as well as Washington is cold and full of excuses. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Miko Pled, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Will Shirin Abu Akleh's Murder Mark a Turning Point in Liberation of Palestine? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The world is trying to make sense of the brutal assassination of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, who was targeted by the Zionist regime forces while covering yet another Israeli assault on Jenin. Furthermore, the Zionist regime forces have now attacked the funeral procession leading Shirin to her final resting place. One wonders, why is anyone surprised? How often have we seen innocent lives taken? How often have we seen the Zionist regime's military attack funeral processions? And yet, for reasons that perhaps cannot be explained, awe, sadness, and despair have descended upon the world with this particular killing. This particular targeted killing of a journalist, not the first and sadly probably not the last, touched us all. And the response of the Zionist regime and Washington is cold and full of excuses. On the same day, the funeral procession of Shirin was taking place in Al-Quds. A memorial procession was taking place in the ancient city of Lid. This procession was to commemorate the murder of Musa Hassouna. It was a year ago in Lid, as settler gangs were assaulting Palestinians in Lid, that Musa Hassouna was murdered. This procession, besides being a memorial to the killing, was also a reminder that the Zionist regime's authorities decided to close the case against the only suspects who were on the scene and who fired their weapons at the same place and the same time as Musa was killed. Sources in Lid say that the Zionist regime's Minister of Interior called the local DA to demand that they close the case on grounds of self-defense. Of course, we are all well aware that Musa and Shirin, who were murdered 1 year apart, were not the only victims of the Zionist regime's violence. They were joined by countless others who, without cause or trial, were taken from their loved ones, from their people, and turned into martyrs for the cause. Sure enough, once again, we are forced to look at reality in the face and accept that no one will save Palestine, but all people around the world united. No one else can free Palestine, no one can save Palestinians from the long, violent, heartless arm of the Zionist apartheid regime. Only a unity of purpose and an uncompromising pro-Palestinian, pro-justice, pro-liberation agenda can save Palestine and its people from bloodshed and destruction. Contrary to the common misconception regarding the pro-Palestinian camp, a clear and uncompromising message regarding Palestine does have the capacity to unite people of different backgrounds, faiths, and even political affiliations. One is hard-pressed to think of any other issue on which all of these groups could find common ground. Yet, Al Alda New York, with its message of a free, decolonized Palestine, managed to do just that. The misconception is that in order to present the Palestine case, in order to achieve the goals of those of Sikh to free Palestine, we must go slow. We must first crawl before we walk and run, we are told. In other words, in order to achieve the liberation of Palestine, we must tread lightly so as not to upset anyone. This was never true, and it is not true today. The opposition to the cause of justice has always been fierce, and in the case of Palestine, the Zionists have learned from other oppressors and refined their methods. This means that the struggle for justice and liberation in Palestine is challenging and demanding. And we who stand on the side of justice and liberation have to work harder and smarter than those who had to fight in the other arenas. We need to reclaim Palestine by teaching the world that what they wrongly refer to as Israel is actually occupied Palestine, and that a glorious history was cut out from the curriculum, and therefore they don't know about the long impressive history of this land, Palestine, which sits at a crucial crossroads uniting Asia, Africa, and Europe. We need to teach the world that whatever the Zionists had told them was a lie. And then we must be there and, in no uncertain terms, provide the truth.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's fresh episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio, I have the honor and privilege of being joined by my sister in faith and humanity and a special guest, Sister Razia Shamli. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my dear sister.
We've been talking a few times in our show about plastic surgery.
In women, we've talked about.
Oh, we talked about it. Oh, so today we want to talk about plastic surgery specified to men.
Yeah.
Because we talked about women.
Yeah.
And their plastic surgery.
We didn't
surgery.
Really talk about women either, but we will talk about.
We dabbled around a little.
Yeah.
I'm not one to say no to plastic surgery completely.
Actually, yesterday I had a friend, a guest invited to over to my house. We were talking about a nose operation, and she had done the rhinoplasty, okay. And I was asking her opinion because I was like looking at it from a very aesthetic way to mm-hmm. see, like, because I don't remember exactly how her previous nose mm-hmm. was, but it was not very nice, and it was a prominent nose, mm-hmm. as you can put it. And she was telling me that she had done the nose job 10 years back, and mm-hmm. she was telling me that it had gotten so, her self-confidence had become so low, aww. That she said that I would not look in the mirror. She's a very pretty girl. She has a PhD. She's from a very good family, and she, because of her nose, she said I was feeling so down and so not confident in myself that whenever anyone wanted to take a picture, I would get frustrated, and I would say, no, I don't want to take any pictures, and didn't even want to tell people that I don't want to take a picture because of my nose, and she didn't even want to look at herself in the mirror. And I was like, oh my God, sometimes some faults within your, nowadays, even if you have like a small nose,
yeah.
some girls are, they are tending towards plastic surgery, mm-hmm. like a nose job, because the shape of their nose is not like stylish anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about these people. Right. But sometimes if you have like a big issue in mm-hmm. your face, well, where it really kills your self-confidence.
Like, you're a woman and you have like petite bone structure, but you inherited your dad's nose.
Exactly. This is the case in
right?
for her. Exactly.
Well, you need a doctor's help
exactly.
to fix it.
Exactly.
And make it more proportionate to your face.
Yeah. And she, despite the nose that her previous nose, her husband had told her she was married.
Mm.
She said, my husband said, look, I'm totally fine with your nose and you don't have to do it for me. I like it. And she said, no, look, I want to do it for myself.
For myself.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
There should be a line in everything. Plastic surgery is obviously not an exception. And Islam, I think the miracle of Islam, the aspect of it that proves its importance and its necessity, actually, for human life is the balance it creates. The balance it presents us, you know, that, all right, this is how you're supposed to be living your life, so you just don't tip off one of the scales. And you just don't fall over the edge of the roof, because it gives you this middle line, right? And I'm not sure, obviously, there was no plastic surgery 1400 years ago. But still, if we have that Islamic mindset, if we have that Islamic attitude, if our brain works Islamically, we'd still be not able to navigate in this area as well.
I was like reading this article where one of the factors that influences where people do go toward plastic surgery or not is religiosity.
Elaborate, please.
The more rooted you are, because the same friend that I'm talking about, she said that when I wanted to do the plastic surgery, she said we were two sisters, and my sister, she didn't have a big nose, but one day she came home and she said, I want to do rhinoplasty. And then she was the first child, mm-hmm. and she said, I had a big problem.
Yeah.
And my dad didn't allow me to have the nose job because he said, look, my love, look, my daughter, what's important is your inner qualities. You have to be, your faith is important, your piety is important, your beauty comes from within. Look at you, focus on your inner beauty. What religion tries to highlight and promote is inner moral values.
Yeah, but then that same religion tells you to comb your hair, dye it if it's gray.
Definitely.
Brush your teeth, make sure your breath doesn't smell like onions,
exactly.
Put on perfume. If you're a woman, get rid of your excess hair.
Yeah, but nowadays there's this scale that if you fall on one side, if one side becomes
heavier yeah.
then the it will be unbalanced.
Mm.
So I think the balance between spirituality and physical beauty, aesthetics, have to be preserved in order to have a nice life.
Obviously.
So what's happening these days is that the balance has tipped off.
Mm.
And on one, there is no spirituality in people's lives. They don't care about your inner beauty. Nowadays, a lot of pretty girls, I'm talking about a religious society. I'm talking about a society where marriage is very important for them. Girls get to be chosen who are prettier.
Okay.
Men, religious and non-religious men, of course, there are, I'm not talking about a norm, but I'm saying that our standards of values have changed, unfortunately. This is something that I'm very sorry to say.
And do you think this is what's been fueling excessive plastic surgery?
Exactly. Because so much attention has been paid to the physical posture of our faces and our bodies these days. And I think it's mostly because of the social media. I was watching another YouTube the other day that women, one thing that statistically speaking, more women are tending towards social media than men.
Mm.
And more, like, the average time spent by a woman is more than the average time spent by the man on the social media. women get more addicted to the social media because men would get addicted to things like video games, some other stuff. But the texture, the quality of the social media is in a way that attracts women. Why? One of the reasons is acceptance, to be seen. And social media, the medium of the social media, provides that groundwork for you, provides the stage for a woman to exhibit herself.
Women like to beautify themselves more than men. They gravitate toward plastic surgery more. While men like to be, like heroism. They like to have a task, a responsibility, and accomplish it. They like to be the savior. And that's why they gravitate toward video games, because they've got that little fantasy world where they can build up a character, and then they have a task, like a quest, and then they accomplish it, and then they get to move up to the next level, and that just really boosts their self-esteem. Unfortunately, it cannot be applied to real life, and then they turn into like... Yeah, but here's the thing, right? In certain woke cultures, there's also this trending phenomenon that women are opting more for that natural look, you know? And like embrace your natural beauty, whatever size, color, shape you are, whatever body part is more disproportionately prominent than the other. Just be comfortable in your own skin. And I don't understand why that has never been a thing for men. I remember like during an episode, you were talking about plus size models. And that they're curvier, they're meatier, they're bigger than your average, like, I don't know, Victoria's Secret model. But then, so that they may empower women and they may abolish those unrealistic beauty standards and women can feel more comfortable and the normal woman can feel more represented. But then again, you don't see the same thing for men. Again, male models are like, they're like shredded buff and they're like, ridiculously physically perfect, and you're wondering then, well, what happens to the man's self-esteem? And is that another reason why he takes refuge into video games? This show is not about video games, by the way, just let me clarify.
That's a very good point that you mentioned.
So this is what I need to know. Where did it shift? Why are men now more interested in plastic surgery?
First of all, I have to make it clear that I don't know if men, I'm just saying that compared to the past, men are opting towards plastic surgery so much more. But if we're reaching a stage where women are tending towards the natural physique, are men still opting toward plastic surgery or not? That's a question that has to be answered on its own basis. And I don't know the answer to that question, but what is actually has made me engaged, has made my mind engaged, is that the answer to your question that, you know, plus size models are becoming prominent in women and they are making, you know, to support women. They're saying, yeah, it's okay to be oversized and you're still beautiful. How about men? Why don't we have plus size model men?
For men, yeah.
I think, as far as my understanding leads me to say, is that there is so much attention. There has been so much attention on feminism and on the problems and challenges of the world of women that their problem has been tackled. And that this is one answer. They have ignored the problem of men. It doesn't mean that men are not facing this problem and we should, you know, be planning plus size models for men. I'm saying that we should go towards that direction as well. But there is one more point, and that is the fact that men do not have this problem as much as women
do. Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to say. Men honestly aren't that self-conscious about themselves as women are.
You know?
And that's why they're not targeted as much either. And enterprises and corporations haven't been able to feed on this insecurity as much as it's been able to do with women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why cosmetics are targeting women,
yeah.
plastic surgery, fashion. All of these things are targeting women because women are more self-conscious about their appearance rather than men. That's all the time we have. But this was a more complicated topic than I anticipated. And obviously, we're going to have to talk about it more. If you guys want to hear more, you can join us on future episodes of Muslim Lady. Until then, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Who is the Lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Islam's victory over joint Arab-Israelite army. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and today, the 17th of Shawwal is the anniversary of a very important event in the history of Islam and humanity, that teaches us that the plots of satanic elements, whether at present or in the future, will continue to fail, since it is God Almighty who has guaranteed the triumph of the righteous, no matter what great armies, strategic alliances, and sophisticated weapons the wayward could muster. It is the day the crucial Battle of Khandaq, or Ditch, also known as Battle of Ahzab, or Confederates, since the Arabs and Israelites had ganged up together against Islam, ended on a victorious note for Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Please stay with us for a special feature. Allah sent back the faithless in the rage, without their attaining any advantage. And Allah spared the faithful of fighting, and Allah is all strong, almighty. This is how the Almighty Creator sums up in Ayah 25 of Surah Ahzab the defeat and retreat of a formidable 10,000-strong joint Arab-Israelite army that had marched upon Medina to kill the Prophet, with the help of the hypocrites amongst the Muslims, and to obliterate Islam. Following the failure of the first ever armed encounter imposed upon the Prophet by the infidels of Mecca at Badr in 2 AH, the Arabs and the Israelites had been fuming with rage and devising plans to uproot Islam. Abu Sufyan, the archenemy of Islam, held talks with the Arabicized Jew Ka'b al-Ashraf, and the two, after showing reciprocal respect for each other's dubious creeds, pledged to muster a formidable joint force against the Seal of Messengers. God Almighty has pointed to this conspiracy in Ayah 53 of Surah Nisa. Have you not regarded those who were given a share of the book, believing in the idol and the evil spirit, and saying of the pagans, these are better guided on the way than those who have faith in Islam? With the mysterious death of Ka'b, the joint plot did not materialize, and the Umayyad infidel Abu Sufyan, in his thirst for avenging the defeat at Badr, marched upon Medina in 4 AH, but failed to achieve his goal. Thanks to the swordsmanship of Imam Ali, peace upon him, that saved the Prophet and Islam in the Battle of Uhud. The next year, in 5 AH, Abu Sufyan assembled warriors from as many Arab tribes as he could, and in league with the Israelite tribes of Banu Nadir and Banu Quraizah, the latter having breached their pledge of neutrality to the Prophet, descended upon Medina with a force of 10,000 that boasted in the ranks the warlord Amr ibn Abduad, who was a veritable giant known for his brute strength. Having been informed of the Arab-Israelite plot against Islam, the Prophet prepared the defenses of Medina, whose natural fortifications were rocky heights and thick palm groves, and, on the suggestion of his Iranian companion, Salman Farsi, dug a deep trench on the strip of the city that was vulnerable to enemy attack. While digging the ditch that involved the removing of huge boulders, which emitted sparks when struck by pickaxes, the Prophet gave tidings of the liberation of Syria, Iran, and Yemen by the Muslims in the future, at which the hypocrites amongst his companions expressed disbelief and hoped that this battle would result in the end of Islam. When the Confederate army arrived, it found its entry blocked by the newly dug ditch. For 15 days, the joint Arab-Israelite forces maneuvered, often shooting arrows at the Muslim defenders on the other side, but couldn't find a way to enter the city. With patience stretched thin, on the 17th of Shawwal, Amr ibn Abdu'l-Wad, along with two other horsemen, found the narrowest point of the ditch and managed to spare their horses for a giant leap to the other side. Amr hurled a spear at the Prophet's tent and challenged the Muslims to single combat, at which most of the newly converted Muslims quaked with fear, while the hypocrites amongst them devised plans to seize the Prophet and hand him over to the enemy. The Prophet of Peace, in order to impart an immortal lesson to mankind that anyone who dares to disregard the sanctity of the Messenger of God and whatever he possesses is worse than an animal, said, "Who will confront this dog?" Thrice he repeated these words, and on all three occasions no one got up except his dear cousin, son-in-law, and divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. Some of the Muslims, who were actually the fifth column, instead of responding to the Prophet's call, started to praise the strength and physical power of Amr ibn Abdu'l-Wad in a bid to demoralize the ranks of the faithful, similar to what the self-styled Muslims in the service of the US and the West do today by extolling the military might of the illegal Zionist entity and the benefits for the Arabs to ally with the Israelis against Islamic Iran. The Prophet gave permission to the Imam to face the challenge of the Arab-Israelite warlord, saying, "The embodiment of faith is all set to fight the embodiment of infidelity. The rest is history, as recorded in all books of hadith and history by both Sunni and Shia Muslim authorities." Imam Ali, peace upon him, after inviting Amr to Islam and telling him to live in peace instead of risking his life, conditions which the arrogantly ignorant pagan spurned, engaged in combat and won the fray. With a flashing stroke of his famous twin-bladed sword, Zulfaqar, Imam Ali, peace upon him, dispatched Amr to the netherworld, but not before allowing him to renew the life and death combat, because the cowardly representative of the Arab-Israelite force, when hurled to the ground, had dared to spit at him. That was among the reasons the Prophet had hailed his cousin's selfless feat, which was solely for the sake of God and without personal emotions involved in the combat, as "The stroke of Ali on the day of Khandaq is superior to the worship of the Thaqalayn'd, mankind and jinn combined." At this spectacle, the Arab-Israelite force, which was viewing the combat from the other side of the ditch, lost heart. And as God Almighty sent strong gales to disrupt their encampment, the enemies fled. Thus, Imam Ali saved the Prophet of Islam and Islam from yet another nefarious plot, and of course, spared the rest of the Muslims, the weak of faith and the hypocrites combined, from a fight for which they had no stomach. The lessons of the Battle of Khandaq are all too obvious for us and teach us that the victory of Islam and Muslims is only possible through firm adherence to the path of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The true path of the Prophet means allegiance to Imam Ali, peace upon him, and the rest of the blessed Ahlul Bayt in these crucial times when global arrogance, led by the great Satan, the United States, has in its ranks an alliance of the devilish Zionist and the reactionary Arab regimes for splitting the unity of the Islamic Ummah through cowardly crimes against Muslims and the rest of humanity. In commemoration of this glorious triumph of Islam over the joint Arab-Israelite force, mosques were built near the site of the ditch in Medina, such as the Fat or Victory Mosque, the Mosque of Imam Ali, peace upon him, the Mosque of the Prophet's daughter Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, and the Mosque of Salman Farsi, the Prophet's Iranian companion, on whose suggestion the ditch was dug at the vulnerable point of Medina to prevent the enemy from entering the city. Over the past millennium and four centuries, pilgrims to the land of revelation and local believers used to offer prayers at these mosques. Unfortunately, these mosques have now been destroyed by the heretical Wahhabi cult, which, despite its claim to be Muslim, follows Abu Sufyan, the infidel Arabs, and the Israelites, as is evident by the open dalliance of Bahrain, the UAE, Egypt, Jordan, and Morocco with the illegal Zionist entity called Israel, along with the secret relations between Tel Aviv and the Riyaz regime. We pray to God Almighty for the reappearance of the Prophet's 12th and last infallible heir, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, and the establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity and justice in order to end tyranny and root all these heretical cults such as the Wahhabis and Takfiris, which have tarnished the image of Islam and Muslims.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.